Dune Messiah by Frank Herbert, continued, Cassette 2, Side 1. Again the tempo of the background music increased.
"Do you know why I enlisted in the Jihad?"
The old eyes stared hard at Skytail.
"I heard there was a thing called a sea. It is very hard to believe in a sea when you have lived only here among our dunes. We have no seas. Men of Dune had never known a sea. We had our wind traps. We collected water for the great change Liet Kynes promised us. This great change Muad'Dib is bringing with a wave of his hand. I could imagine a Khanat, water flowing across the land in a canal. From this, my mind could picture a river. But a sea?"
Farrakh gazed at the translucent cover of his courtyard, as though trying to probe into the universe beyond.
"A sea?" he said, voice low. "It was too much for my mind to picture. Yet men I knew said they had seen this marvel. I thought they lied, but I had to know for myself. It was for this reason that I enlisted."
The youth struck a loud final chord on the balisette, took up a new song with an oddly undulating rhythm.
"Did you find your sea?" Skytail asked.
Farrakh remained silent, and Skytail thought the old man had not heard. The balisette music rose around them and fell like a tidal movement. Farrakh breathed to its rhythm.
"There was a sunset," Farrakh said presently. "One of the elder artists might have painted such a sunset. It had red in it, the color of the glass in my bottle. There was gold, blue. It was on the world they call Enfail, the one where I led my legion to victory. We came out of a mountain pass where the air was sick with water. I could scarcely breathe it. And there below me was the thing my friends had told me about. Water, as far as I could see, and farther. We marched down to it. I waded out into it and drank. It was bitter and made me ill. But the wonder of it has never left me."
Skytail found himself sharing the old Fremen's awe.
"I immersed myself in that sea," Farrakh said, looking down at the water creatures worked into the tiles of his floor. "One man sank beneath that water. Another man arose from it. I felt that I could remember a past which had never been. I stared around me with eyes which could accept anything, anything at all. I saw a body in the water, one of the defenders we had slain. There was a log nearby supported on that water, a piece of a great tree. I can close my eyes now and see that log. It was black on one end from a fire, and there was a piece of cloth in that water, no more than a yellow rag, torn, dirty. I looked at all these things, and I understood why they had come to this place. It was for me to see them."
Farrakh turned slowly, stared into Skytail's eyes.
"The universe is unfinished, you know," he said.
"This one is garrulous but deep," Skytail thought, and he said, "I can see it made a profound impression on you."
"You are a Tlaelaxu," Farrakh said. "You have seen many seas. I have seen only this one, yet I know a thing about seas which you do not."
Skytail found himself in the grip of an odd feeling of disquiet.
"The mother of chaos was born in a sea," Farrakh said. "A Kizara Tafwid stood nearby when I came dripping from that water. He had not entered the sea. He stood on the sand, it was wet sand, with some of my men who shared his fear. He watched me with eyes that knew I had learned something which was denied to him. I had become a sea creature, and I frightened him. The sea healed me of the Jihad, and I think he saw this."
Skytail realized that somewhere in this recital the music had stopped. He found it disturbing that he could not place the instant when the balisette had fallen silent. As though it were relevant to what he'd been recounting, Farrakh said,
"Every gate is guarded. There's no way into the Emperor's fortress."
"That's its weakness," Skytail said.
Farrakh stretched his neck upward, peering.
"There's a way in," Skytail explained. "The fact that most men, including, we may hope, the Emperor, believe otherwise, that's to our advantage."
He rubbed his lips, feeling the strangeness of the visage he'd chosen. The musician's silence bothered him. Did it mean Farrakh's son was through transmitting? That had been the way of it, naturally. The message condensed and transmitted within the music. It had been impressed upon Skytail's own neutral system,
there to be triggered at the proper moment by the distrans embedded in his adrenal cortex. If it was ended, he had become a container of unknown words. He was a vessel sloshing with data. Every cell of the conspiracy here on Arrakis, every name, every contact phrase, all the vital information. With this information, they could brave Arrakis, capture a sandworm, begin the culture of Melange somewhere beyond Muad'Dib's writ. They could break the monopoly as they broke Muad'Dib. They could do many things with this information.
"We have the woman here," Farrakh said. "Do you wish to see her now?"
"I've seen her," Skytail said. "I've studied her with care. Where is she?" Farrakh snapped his fingers. The youth took up his rebeck, drew the bow across it. Samuta music wailed from the strings. As though drawn by the sound, a young woman in a blue robe emerged from a doorway behind the musician. Narcotic dullness filled her eyes, which were the total blue of the Ibad. She was a Fremen, addicted to the spice, and now caught by an off-world vice. Her awareness lay deep within the Samuta, lost somewhere, and riding the ecstasy of the music.
"O Thame's daughter," Farrakh said. "My son gave her the narcotic in the hope of winning a woman of the people for himself, despite his blindness. As you can see, his victory is empty. Samuta has taken what he hoped to gain."
"Her father doesn't know?" Skytail asked.
"She doesn't even know," Farrakh said. "My son supplies false memories with which she accounts to herself for her visits. She thinks herself in love with him. This is what her family believes. They are outraged because he is not a complete man, but they won't interfere, of course."
The music trailed away to silence. At a gesture from the musician, the young woman seated herself beside him, bent close to listen as he murmured to her.
"What will you do with her?" Farrakh asked.
Once more, Skytail studied the courtyard.
"Who else is in this house?" he asked.
"We are all here now," Farrakh said. "You've not told me what you'll do with the woman. It is my son who wishes to know."
As though about to answer, Skytail extended his right arm. From the sleeve of his robe, a glistening needle darted, embedded itself in Farrakh's neck. There was no outcry, no change of posture. Farrakh would be dead in a minute, but he sat unmoving, frozen by the dart's poison. Slowly, Skytail climbed to his feet, crossed to the blind musician. The youth was still murmuring to the young woman when the dart whipped into him. Skytail took the young woman's arm, urged her gently to her feet, shifted his own appearance before she looked at him. She came erect, focused on him.
"What is it, Farrakh?" she asked.
"My son is tired and must rest," Skytail said. "Come, we'll go out the back way."
"We had such a nice talk," she said. "I think I've convinced him to get Tlaelaxu eyes. It'd make a man of him again."
"Haven't I said it many times?" Skytail asked, urging her into a rear chamber.
His voice, he noted with pride, matched his features precisely. It unmistakably was the voice of the old Fremen, who certainly was dead by this time. Skytail sighed. It had been done with sympathy, he told himself, and the victims certainly had known their peril. Now, the young woman would have to be given her chance. Empires do not suffer emptiness of purpose at the time of their creation. It is when they have become established that aims are lost and replaced by vague ritual. Words of Muad'Dib by Princess Irulan. It was going to be a bad session, this meeting of the Imperial Council, Alia realized. She sensed contention gathering force, storing up energy, the way Irulan refused to look at Chani, Stilgar's nervous shuffling of papers, the scowls Paul directed at Korba the Kizara. She seated herself at the end of the golden council table so she could look out the balcony windows at the dusty light of the afternoon. Korba, interrupted by her entrance, went on with something he'd been saying to Paul.
"What I mean, my lord, is that there aren't as many gods as once there were."
Alia laughed, throwing her head back. The movement dropped the black hood of her Aba robe. Her features lay exposed, blue in blue spice eyes, her mother's oval face beneath a cap of bronze hair, small nose, mouth wide and generous. Korba's cheeks went almost the color of his orange robe. He glared at Alia, an angry gnome, bald and fuming.
"Do you know what's being said about your brother?" he demanded. "I know what's being said about your Kizarat," Alia countered. "You're not divines. You're God's spies."
Korba glanced at Paul for support, said,
We are sent by the writ of Muad'Dib, that he shall know the truth of his people, and they shall know the truth of him.
Spies, Alia said.
Korba pursed his lips in injured silence. Paul looked at his sister, wondering why she provoked Korba. Abruptly, he saw that Alia had passed into womanhood, beautiful with the first blazing innocence of youth. He found himself surprised that he hadn't noticed it until this moment. She was 15, almost 16, a reverend mother without motherhood, virgin priestess, object of fearful veneration for the superstitious masses, Alia of the Knife.
"This is not the time or place for your sister's levity," Irulan said.
Paul ignored her, nodded to Korba.
"The square's full of pilgrims. Go out and lead their prayer."
"But they expect you, my lord," Korba said.
"Put on your turban," Paul said. "They'll never know at this distance."
Irulan smothered irritation at being ignored, watched Korba arise to obey. She'd had the sudden disquieting thought that Edric might not hide her actions from Alia.
"What do we really know of the sister?" she wondered.
Chani, hands tightly clasped in her lap, glanced across the table at Stilgar, her uncle, Paul's minister of state. Did the old Fremen Naib ever long for the simpler life of his desert siege, she wondered. Stilgar's black hair, she noted, had begun to gray at the edges, but his eyes beneath heavy brows remained far-seeing. It was the eagle stare of the wild, and his beard still carried the catch-tube indentation of life in a stillsuit. Made nervous by Chani's attention, Stilgar looked around the council chamber. His gaze fell on the balcony window and Korba standing outside. Korba raised outstretched arms for the benediction, and a trick of the afternoon sun cast a red halo onto the window behind him. For a moment, Stilgar saw the court Kizara as a figure crucified on a fiery, fiery wheel. Korba lowered his arms, destroyed the illusion, but Stilgar remained shaken by it. His thoughts went in angry frustration to the fawning supplicants waiting in the audience hall, and to the hateful pomp which surrounded Muad'Dib's throne. Convening with the Emperor, one hoped for a fault in him, to find mistakes, Stilgar thought. He felt this might be sacrilege, but wanted it anyway. Distant crowd murmuring entered the chamber as Korba returned. The balcony door thumped into its seals behind him, shutting off the sound. Paul's gaze followed the Kizara. Korba took his seat at Paul's left, dark features composed, eyes glazed by fanaticism. He'd enjoyed that moment of religious power.
"The spirit presence has been invoked," he said. "Thank the Lord for that," Alia said.
Korba's lips went white. Again, Paul studied his sister, wondered at her motives. Her innocence masked deception, he told himself. She'd come out of the same Bene Gesserit breeding program as he had. What had the Kwisatz Haderach genetics produced in her? There was always that mysterious difference. She'd been an embryo in the womb when her mother had survived the raw melange poison. Mother and unborn daughter had become reverend mothers simultaneously. But simultaneity didn't carry identity. Of the experience, Alia said that in one terrifying instant she had awakened to consciousness, her memory absorbing the uncounted other lives which her mother was assimilating.
"I became my mother and all the others," she said. "I was unformed, unborn, but I became an old woman then and there."
Sensing his thoughts on her, Alia smiled at Paul. His expression softened. How could anyone react to Korba with other than cynical humor, he asked himself. What is more ridiculous than a death commando transformed into a priest? Stilgar tapped his papers.
"If my liege permits," he said. "These are matters urgent and dire."
"The two-pile treaty?" Paul asked.